Speed, because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hello there, and welcome to another edition of My Science Project. I am your co-host, Julia, coming at you from Calgary. And, of course, is coming at you from Vancouver every other week. We swap around. Today's show is inspired by the upcoming Earth Day, April 22nd. Of course, every day is really Earth Day. But to celebrate an official Earth Day, April 22nd, the show will deal with a few topics related to sustainability, including the impact of climate change on beer, and then the impact of beer on science. We'll have a look at a much-hated aspect of the banana. It has nothing to do with sustainability, it's just fun. I'll tell you a bit about some resources for ways that you can do your own science from the comfort of your own home, and tons more. We'll journey, of course, through some of the latest and not a little unusual science news, and I think I'll kick off the show with that. Some of these stories are definitely in keeping with our theme of greening up and sustainability. If you can believe it, our first story is about green condoms. Now, I don't mean literally green condoms. I mean sustainable condoms. And I don't mean reuse, reduce, recycle kind of thing with these condoms either. That's not where we're going with this story. Nature News recently reported that the Brazilian government aims to safeguard the Amazon by marketing condoms made from sustainably harvested rubber trees in their rainforests. Another Nature News story that I think goes to prove the adage that if it isn't serious, it can't be laughed at, is that spiteful hackers pulled a less than noble prank. They hijacked the online forum of the Epilepsy Foundation, adding strobing graphics that triggered seizures in some of the users. That's just chalking up bad karma, isn't it? Another news story that's actually reminiscent of I Am Legend, Richard Matheson's book that was recently a Will Smith film. The first ever cancer vaccine has been reported. A New York-based biotech company announced, and this was reported in The Scientist earlier this month in April, that this company had received approval for the first therapeutic cancer vaccine, but only in Russia. Now, it's the first approval by a regulatory body of a cancer immunotherapy. This antibody-based therapy is called oncophage, and it received a registration certificate from the Russian Ministry of Public Health to treat a subset of kidney cancer patients who are at intermediate risk for disease recurrence. It's basically then not to anticipate cancer before it even happens, but it's to reduce the risk of cancer recurring in patients who've already experienced this disease. The treatment is made from patients' tumor cells and increased recurrence-free survival in their test sample by almost 2 years, according to the results of the company's phase 3 clinical trial. Cancer immunotherapy has long been a field riddled with scientific challenges, The pharma market in Russia, however, seems to be growing astronomically, and it's a way that this company has got a foothold into this idea of cancer immunotherapy. Christopher Wood, a cancer researcher at MD Anderson Cancer Center who led this clinical trial, said that the company had assured him that they plan to use the proceeds from any Russian sales of the treatment to fund a study for FDA approval, hence bringing this treatment to North America, or in particular to the States. Wood also noted that the data has been submitted for publication, so that should mean that this trial will be peer-reviewed and deemed effective or not. Our next story begs the question, where's the beef? The answer to this might be in your test tube. Wired magazine recently reported that scientists are fleshing out plans to grow and sell test tube meat. According to a new economic analysis presented at the In Vitro Meat Symposium, I'm sorry I missed that one, in Norway, meat grown in giant tanks known as bioreactors would cost between about $5,200 to $5,500 a ton. And the analysis claims that this is cost competitive with European beef prices. With a rising global middle class projected by the UN to double meat consumption by the year 2050, and livestock already responsible for 18% of greenhouse gases, this In Vitro Meat Symposium has drawn a variety of scientists, environmentalists, and food industry experts who are looking to tackle this challenge. Anthony Bennett of the UN Food and Agricultural Organization said, "We're looking to see if there are other technologies that can produce food for all the people on the planet, not only today, but over the next 20, 30 years. In vitro meat production is a specialized form of tissue engineering. That's no surprise, I suppose. Proponents say it will ultimately reduce the carbon footprint of meat products." Now, the science aside, this begs a question about what these meats taste like when they're grown in test tubes. Scientists are working on a variety of cell culture procedures. The cutting edge of in vitro meat engineering is the attempt to get cells to grow as if they were inside a living animal, which leads to taste, because meat like steak is a complex combination of muscle, fat, and other connective tissue, and reproducing the complexity of this natural meat composition is proving, perhaps not unsurprisingly, difficult for these scientists. Once the meat is made, consumer acceptance is still far from assured. No one seems to be able to comment on what cultured meat will taste like. Some scientists think it could be used to create novel foods that, get this, won't quite be meat, but won't quite be like anything else either. None of the experts were sure if there is a large market of early adopters who want to eat test tube meat for environmental health or ethical reasons. It just reminds me when I saw a product called Chicken in a Tube, and that put me off. But, you know, I guess keep an open mind, right? Test tube meat. The last story, and this is, again, environmentally oriented, is about biofuels. There's a fellow named Philip Larkin who works at Black Mountain Laboratory in Canberra, and he does a lot of intensive research on poppies and does gene expression analyses of these plants in order to basically genetically modify them to our advantage. Now, geologist Eric Frost, who's the founder of San Diego State University's Homeland Security Problem, and his colleagues were brainstorming ways to transform Afghanistan's opium poppy economy into a legal enterprise. And they ended up contacting Philip Larkin for his input because of Larkin's research on poppies. It turns out that opium poppies are known for their oily seeds. In fact, their oil content ranks up with canola oil. Compared with the palm-based biodiesel that's now used in Europe, poppy oils would actually run better at colder temperatures. And poppy agriculture doesn't require destroying tropical forests, which is a plus. It's little known that actually in Tasmania, since the 1950s, this island has supplied as much as 40% of the world's medicinal morphine. In 2005, Tasmanian farmers had even experimented with running their tractors on poppy biodiesel. Larkin predicts that small biodiesel plants based on poppies could supply power to Afghanistan's numerous rural communities, but scientists could eventually increase the oleic oil content in the seeds through genetic modification to make them more valuable for export.
I've got my hunches. It's the best, beats the rest. Cellular, modular, interactive, modular. Ring, 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 ring. Banana phone. Ping, pong, ping, pong, ping, pong, ping. Banana phone. It's no baloney. It ain't a phony. My cellular. I'll call my cat. I'll call the White House. Have a chat. I'll place a call around the world. Operator, get me Beijing, jing, jing, jing.
Was the inimitable Raffi with his song Banana Phone. You're listening to my science project on CITR 101.9 FM. The show is a smattering of science items, but predominantly related to sustainability, and all in honor of the upcoming Earth Day. This next story, though, however, has absolutely nothing to do with sustainability. It's about something that I don't think a lot of us talk about. And I don't think that we even recognize that it's a problem and that there's actually a lot of us who share the same feeling about this issue. And in fact, I would challenge any of you to actually come up with the proper scientific term or even any kind of formalized, standardized term for what's really at the heart of this problem. Do any of you out there enjoy eating those stringy bits on the banana? And do you know what they're called? Well, I can say no to the first question and pretty much no to the second question until I actually did a little bit of background digging into the fact that banana strings have a proper name. Banana strings are actually officially called, in scientific terms, phloem, and that's spelled P-H-L-O-E-M. So it sort of reads like phloem, but pronounced phloem. Bananas, as I think we all know, are a really valuable source of potassium. They're also particularly rich in vitamin B, and surprisingly in vitamin C. One banana gives you about 15% of your daily recommended intake. They're also incredibly low in fat, to the point that there's almost really no fat in them. And one banana gives you about 100 calories worth of energy. The strings on the bananas, or the phloem, are part of the vascular system of this fruit. These bundles expand to carry nourishment when the banana develops and help to strengthen the peel tissues. But by the time the banana gets to you, the function of the phloems is over and they shrink, often leaving marks in the flesh. Phloems are also called phloem bundles. An interesting fact is that bananas actually do not grow on trees. They're grown on a plant, and that's made up of soft, overlapping leaves which can grow up to 30 feet high, making it the largest plant on Earth without a woody stem. So all those overlapping leaves that look like the trunk aren't. They're just the leaves themselves. So as I mentioned, phloem is the living tissue that carries organic nutrients, particularly sucrose, to all the parts of the plant where it's needed. And phloem tissue consists of less specialized and nucleate cells called parenchyma cells. They also are composed of sieve tube cells and companion cells. Basically, the sieve tube members are joined end to end to form a tube that conducts food materials throughout the plant. But the survival of the sieve tube cells is dependent upon this other group of cells called companion cells. And all of the cellular functions of sieve tube element are carried out by these much smaller companion cells. I couldn't find any information about pros or cons of these phloem bundles. There's really surprisingly scant amount of information out there about this stuff, but, you know, it's part of the fruit. Presumably, there's no problem eating it at all. It's just kind of yucky. The texture's yucky. So I always peel it off, but sometimes they get stuck, and then I have to eat one anyway. Ugh. So yeah, if you like phloem bundles in your bananas, let Anne and I know. We'll do a really unscientific survey and report it in a future show. This is a band called, I believe, Strings of Pith, with their identically titled song, Strings of Pith, or the Banana Hate Song.
Listening to
CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
Ice cream man, can I have this? I want this over here, and a toast on by my father, and give me this ice over here, and vanilla cone. Thank you, ice cream man. Thank you, ice cream man.
Earth Day, huh? That sounds like a very noble cause. How much does it pay?
I stumbled across a recent article that actually just came out online. I don't think it's even pressed yet. It's in a journal called Ecological Economics, and the authors are Guido Buenstorff and Christian Cordes. Both are out of the Max Planck Institute of Economics in Germany. In a nutshell, their study looked at the tendency of consumers to become sustainable in their buying decisions. And they examined the different factors that contribute to consumers like you and I choosing to buy a sustainable or a green product over a less sustainable or completely unsustainable product. They found really interesting things out of this study, and things that I think are very applicable to real-life situations. In their study, they assert that consumer learning is critical for the diffusion of sustainable consumption patterns. The acquisition of consumption knowledge is shaped by the information that you or I are exposed to as consumers. However, information availability is only to a minor extent within the control of you or I. In other words, we're sort of victims of what is out there, what's available to us, unless we're particularly proactive. For example, if you want to buy a stereo system or a car, and you do a lot of intensive research because the product is very expensive, and making the wrong choice will have a big impact on your happiness and enjoyment of your purchase. Those kinds of purchasing decisions aside, the majority of consumption-related information, the authors assert, is provided by our social environment. And in fact, role models are a very powerful way in which social groups and mass media influence individual behavior. Now, this isn't rocket science or anything new. All you have to do is look at the pop stars who are endorsing various products and the popularity of these products, whether they're featured in a music video or whether they're actually bearing the name of the celebrity, him or herself. There's an evolutionary slant to this because in terms of our development as a species, selection has favored social learners who were able to evaluate potential models, such as role models, and copy the most successful among them, thereby saving the cost of individual learning. So it's kind of a quick, dirty, and lazy way to get ahead. You just look for the people who are successful, however that's defined, whether they're the ones with the more mates, the more food, resources, kids. You see what they're doing, and you emulate. And if that means buying a really expensive gas-guzzling car, then in the context of success, that's what you go and do. Now, environmentally conscious goods are a tricky thing because there's no direct sensory appreciation for the effect that they have. For example, you don't experience typically the fact that they're not polluting. You just read that on the package or you take it as faith. So unlike more conspicuous consumption where you get to enjoy, let's say, buying a vehicle, you're maybe not really directly enjoying the benefits of having an environmentally friendly car or household cleaner. Part of the trick to getting consumers to convert to environmentally sensitive goods is through associative learning. So basically, as consumers, we get a Pavlovian gratification response. We buy things, we feel really happy about them. And part of the trick of encouraging sustainability amongst consumers is making that neurological, very real link between the gratification, the sense of reward from buying an environmentally friendly product versus the unsustainable alternative. So this is what's called this hedonistic bias in consumer behavior. We like hedonism. We tend to be hedonistic. We tend to go for the thrill, the instant gratification purchase, the thing we can feel and touch and see. For associative learning to take place in terms of green buying, there is a need for explicit consumer knowledge about differences in the environmental impact of close substitutes. Basically, you need to be very tuned into what the benefits of one product are over another and fairly proactive in being aware of the differences between them. However, as I mentioned earlier, consumer acquisition of explicit knowledge about environmentally relevant goods is highly dependent on the social environment. So in other words, as we become more green as a society and people talk up the benefits of these things more and more people are aware of the advantages of buying green products. But in a society where climate change really isn't a big deal and not publicized or discussed, consumers will receive comparatively very limited information about the benefits of going green. What was really interesting about this article is that even if we become green consumers, it doesn't mean that that change is permanent. In fact, it's sort of a slippery backward slope where if there isn't a consistent and concerted effort to green up consumer buying choices, people, because of this whole role model idea, because of the idea that success and role models are in constant flux depending upon societal context, whether it's a new generation coming up that has different value systems or changes in trends or what kind of information is disseminated to the public through the media, we can end up not buying green anymore. It's not a permanent conversion. And I think that's what's really key in this article. The point that they drive home at the end is that we shouldn't be overly optimistic or take for granted our shift in the greening of our buying choices. And in fact, there need to be a couple of measures taken to consistently ensure that the general public goes and remains green in their buying choices. One of these is that basically they say the nature of human learning is too flexible, and the effect of aggregate environmental problems on individual consumer behavior is too indirect for learning to uniformly favor sustainability. So basically, we're human beings, we're meant to be flexible, we're meant to be adaptable. That's how we have succeeded as a species and basically mucked the planet up. But because we don't directly see the effects of climate change, for example, although there's tons of evidence out there that is showing direct effects, essentially the authors are saying we need government policy, we need laws, we need legislation that will enforce green habits. The other thing that they say, basically they say a green consumption regime that has been established in a population does not, quote, lock in. It's not immune to changes in the strengths of the alternative biases, such as buying hedonistic cars. So another strategy to ensure that we take responsibility as consumers is the continual and active enlisting of green role models, whether those are politicians, celebrities, who knows. But it's an interesting idea that, I mean, do you go and enlist the most popular celebrities of the moment and have them set green examples? The other thing the authors suggest is that there be a direct attempt to educate consumers, for example, through eco-labeling of products, which will tell them about resource and energy intensity of the product manufacture or usage, and other things such as eco-taxes, ways to alleviate the financial burden of people buying products that are more sustainable but might cost them a bit more, and hence they might not make that choice otherwise unless it was subsidized. So consider your purchasing decision and how you're influenced. It's an interesting experiment when you go to the shop and you make decisions and you're weighing sustainable versus unsustainable. I wouldn't have thought I would be very impacted by the things around me, because you think in scientific terms, oh, well, climate change, of course it's happening, of course I have to take responsibility, of course it's not going away. But I think it's an interesting lesson for all of us to be aware of these subtleties in our purchasing choices and how we're influenced. Anyway, if you're interested in checking that out, the paper is, again, in Ecological Economics. It's this year. It's online. It should be in press in the next little while. And the authors are Buenstorf and Cordes. The title is Can Sustainable Consumption Be Learned? A Model of Cultural Evolution. And speaking of conspicuous consumption, it turns out, as Nature News reported a few weeks ago, that money can indeed buy happiness, especially if you give it away. Nature was reporting on a study that actually you can find in Science. That's volume 319 by Elizabeth Dunn, who's a psychologist at UBC, actually, and her two colleagues found that the more cash that people give to charity and to friends, the happier they tend to be. It's known that the more money people make, the happier on average they are. Although, the caveat to this is that this effect is actually remarkably small, particularly among people who have enough money to meet their basic needs. So the next question is, well, if earning money makes you happier, how much happiness does it buy, and how might money buy happiness? So this is what Elizabeth Dunn and her colleagues set out to do. They asked people how much money they made, how they spent their money, and how happy they were. They sampled over 600 Americans, and they found that an average of nearly 10% of the monthly budget was spent on what Dunn terms pro-social spending, which means gifts for others and donations to charity. overall spending levels were not related to happiness, but pro-social spending was. The effect of spending a dollar on other people was similar in magnitude to earning an extra dollar in income, in terms of the happiness that people got. The researchers then compared the happiness of 16 employees before and after receiving a salary bonus from their companies, and again they found that the employees who spent a larger fraction of their bonus on other people were happier than the employees who did not. These two studies left open the question that whether spending money on your friends really makes you happy, or if happy people spend more money on their friends. So one morning, Elizabeth Dunn and colleagues gave 46 students, probably UBC students, an envelope with $5 or $20. And then they assigned these students to either spend the money on themselves or on friends. At the end of the day, the students who had given away their money were happier than the students who had spent it on themselves, and the amount of money that they were given and spent had no effect on their happiness. Dunn notes that the sad irony of this study is that when people come to view money as a route to happiness, they are less likely to part with it, which is in fact the opposite of what they're finding, that giving away some money makes you happier.
Butterflies, you think it's devil's eyes, you think it takes a lifetime, and you think it goes away.
You're listening to my science project on CITR 101.9 FM. I mentioned earlier the idea of sustainable consumer choices and climate change, and there being a sort of disconnect between the two because the effects of our purchasing choices and how they affect our environment aren't always crystal clear. But climate change is manifesting itself in interesting ways, and one of those ways is how we drink and enjoy alcohol, particularly beer. There have been a couple of stories in the last year or so in particular that have brought to attention how global warming is mucking up with the beer and wine industry. And it was recently reported, in fact, earlier this month, that in New Zealand and Australia, the beer production is taking a big hit. Jim Salinger is a climate scientist at New Zealand's National Institute of Water and Atmospheric Research. And he said that climate change likely will cause a decline in the production of malting barley in parts of New Zealand and Australia. Why is this important? Well, malting barley is a key ingredient of beer. Basically, this means that either there will be pubs without beer, or the cost of beer is going to go up. Climate change, if it continues as it is going, or gets worse, could cause a drop in beer production within 30 years, especially in parts of Australia, as dry areas become drier and water shortages worsen. Barley is grown in various parts in Australia, Western Australia, South Australia, Victoria, and New South Wales. It's also grown in New Zealand's South Island. Australia would be particularly hard hit by the climate change because it's already a drier climate than in New Zealand's South Island. New Zealand and Australian brewer Lion Nathan's corporate affairs director, Liz Reed, commented that climate change was already forcing up the price of malted barley, sugar, aluminum, and that this meant that, in addition to climate change, barley growers are also grappling with competition from other forms of land use, such as dairy industry. So not only is climate change putting pressure on these barley farmers, but the need to use that land for other purposes is too. I'm sure Australians are very unhappy with the idea of increased beer costs or decreased beer availability. But it's not just Australia that's suffering. Europe is suffering as well. The Climate Institute, which is an organization, an NGO that's been around for more than 20 years, on their website, which is www.climate.org, has a section about how climate change is affecting beer and wine, particularly in Germany. If you can think back a couple of summers to 2006, that European heat wave brought an uncharacteristically hot and stormy summer that ended up greatly damaging Germany's vital barley crop. Malting barley is legally an essential ingredient in making beer according to Germany's purity law, and brewers are really fussy about this as well. Brewers are legally unable to substitute barley with rice and corn, which, who knows, maybe in future this law will have to be changed and brewers will have to compromise. Being arguably the most particular of all, German brewers will only accept the highest quality barley for their malt, at least under current conditions. The bad weather in Europe had cut the usable yield of high-quality barley from 1.6 million tons to 1.2 million tons in that year alone. This drove the price up from 270 euros a ton 2 years ago to around 385 euros a ton, according to the Bavarian Brewers Association, which is more than a 40% increase. A second set of challenges also faces the brewers, basically through the growing trend to develop biofuels in Germany. Many farmers are leaving the barley business altogether and adopting the easier, more lucrative, and heavily subsidized crops needed for environmentally friendly biofuels, which is sort of a similar situation to what Australian farmers are confronting with this pressure for, let's say, other agricultural needs for the land. So enjoy your beer while you can. This is quite a tragedy, I think, and particularly for scientists, because scientists, contrary to popular belief, actually do a lot of their thinking and socializing over beer. And a related story found some interesting information about how beer consumption can impact scientific productivity. Thomas Grimm is an ornithologist at Palaki University in the Czech Republic. And unfortunately, in 1999, Thomas Grimm came down with a really bad case of mono. This prevented him from drinking beer for about a year. But soon after he recovered, he began publishing papers in more high-profile scientific journals, which got him thinking about this connection between his improved scientific productivity and his reduced beer consumption. So he started doing a survey of his own. He showed that something entirely unexpected and considerably sudsier than other factors such as genius, sex, and dumb luck might be at play in determining the success or failure of scientists. And this indeed was beer. Now, Thomas Grimm's study was published in February in a journal called Oikos, which is a highly respected scientific journal. And he found that the more beer a scientist drinks, the less likely the scientist is to publish a paper or to have a paper cited by another researcher. And citation is big currency in the scientific business, basically. The more people who cite your paper, the more times you're cited, the better for you. Instead, it was found in the study that scientific performance steadily declined with increasing beer consumption across the board. From scientists who would sip 2 to 3 beers over a year to those who would knock back multiple beers in a day. Now, the study was a little bit biased because Thomas Grimm is an ornithologist and he studied other ornithologists, so it wasn't like scientists across the board in all kinds of different fields. But he did carry out the study at 2 occasions, once in 2002 and then in 2006, and got the same results in each time. His finding also showed no indication that some level of moderate social beer drinking increases scientific productivity, so it doesn't necessarily work the other way around. Some scientists have also suggested that biologists in the Czech Republic could prove to be a bit of an anomaly, given that the Czech Republic has a special relationship to beer, boasting the highest rate of beer consumption on Earth. And hence, I presume they will be most hardly hit by changes to beer prices and availability due to climate change. But that aside, more important, as Dr. Grimm pointed out, the study documents a correlation between beer drinking and scientific performance, but it doesn't explain this correlation. So it's possible that beer drinking doesn't cause poor scientific performance, but it's the opposite. Poor scientific performance, in fact, drives scientists to drown their sorrows in massive amounts of drink. The flip side, of course, to beer affecting scientific productivity in a negative way, if indeed beer does this, is using drugs to enhance cognitive function to do scientific research. Earlier this month, Nature presented a poll where they asked scientists about their use of brain-enhancing drugs. 1 in 5 Nature readers, mostly scientists, say that they up their mental performance with drugs such as Ritalin, Provigil, and Inderal. The online poll asked readers how they felt about professional thinkers using drugs to enhance their cognitive performance, and nearly 80% said that it should be allowed. While only 1/5 of the poll's 1,400 respondents admitted to drug use to improve concentration, nearly 2/3 said that they knew of a colleague who did use the drugs. And if there were a normal risk of mild side effects, nearly 70% of the scientists said they'd boost their brain power by taking a cognitive-enhancing drug. Interestingly, although scientists from all over the world participated, 70% of respondents said they were from the States. And the most popular drug by far was Ritalin, used by 62% of respondents. Provigil was the drug of choice for 44% of those polled, suggesting that many users are taking more than one drug. Most respondents said they took the drugs to improve concentration or to improve focus for a specific task. Counteracting jet lag, of all things, was another popular reason why these drugs were used. One alarming poll finding was how often respondents used brain-boosting drugs. It was an even split, with about 25% of users saying they took the drugs daily, weekly, monthly, or once a year at most. This poll followed an article published in December of 2007 in Nature. It was an editorial in which Cambridge neuroscience professors Barbara Sahakian and Sharon Maureen Zamir reported on the growing use of drugs to boost brain power.
She'll make a lovely doll after I finish with you. I told you your webs were useless.
Spider-Man! He's melting!
It's too hot. It's too hot. Something must have hit the control lever. Turn it off.
Want to save energy and keep yourself comfortable? Turn down your thermostat 1 degree Celsius or consider installing a programmable thermostat. If every household in BC with electric space heating turned down their heat by 1 degree for 8 hours a day, it would save enough electricity to power Science World for over 75 years. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
If any of you guys out there have a hankering to do a bit of science on your own time, you guys might have heard of SETI at Home, which is currently the most popular distributed computing program that searches for signals from extraterrestrial intelligence, basically uses home computers at the same time to form a supercomputer. But there's another similar kind of initiative that is starting up that you may be able to participate in, and this is called Quake Catcher Network. Basically, Elizabeth Cochran, who is a geophysicist at the University of California, Riverside, and her colleague, seismologist Jesse Lawrence, who's at Stanford, have developed a computer program for tracking earthquakes in real time. This uses thousands of volunteers' computers and may someday be fast enough to issue warnings just before an earthquake strikes. How it works is pretty cool. It uses the accelerometers that are built into many new computers, and these sense when a computer is dropped so that the hard drive can be shut down. The scientists found out that the sensors could pick up on more subtle movement. So basically, when a computer is signed up to the program, it senses shaking and can calculate the intensity and ping the information back to the Quake Catcher servers at Stanford in less than a second. QuakeCatcher is looking at the inner workings of earthquakes because very little is known about how seismic waves travel and refract deep in Earth's crust. So basically, to model this movement takes enormous amounts of computing power, which is where all these home computers come in. If it works, QuakeCatcher will be the cheapest seismic network on the planet and could operate in any country. In addition to becoming a warning system for earthquakes, it also has a really big educational component. For example, students can drop heavy objects on the floor at varying distances from the computer to design and monitor their own earthquakes. I can just see how popular this is going to be with teachers worldwide. But if you're interested in the Quake Catcher Network, all you have to do is go to the website, HTTP, blah, 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 qcn.ucr.edu. That's Quake Catcher Network, qcn.ucr.edu, for more information and to become part of the scientific experiment. If you want to do your own scientific research, for example, if you want to study disease, particular illness and the therapies that are being done to help cure it or prevent it, the National Institutes of Health has just announced and begun a mandate as of April 7th requiring that all research funded by NIH dollars be deposited into PubMed Central within 1 year of publication. And this pretty much means open access for all of these articles that have been funded by the NIH. Now, this is a U.S. organization, but it's possible for Canadian researchers to get NIH funds, so it does apply to us. And because the NIH is this federal funding body, there's also the chance that it's going to impact the decisions of, for example, our federal funding organizations like the Canadian Institutes of Health Research, CIHR. And it may well be that we see a lot more of this open access going on a lot faster, so that all of us, especially because our tax dollars are going to CIHR-funded research programs, we can access these studies ourselves. Lastly, I'll leave you with a few resources that I came across. I think this is really cool. This is a website from the European Synchrotron Radiation Facility. The website is www.esrf.eu. And if you want to see what is trapped in opaque amber, all kinds of different insects, flies, wasps, ants, spiders, even feathers in 3D, super cool. www.esrf.eu for the paleontologists among you out there. Another website, just for fun, is something called XKCD. This is a website of basically science-related comics produced by Randall Monroe, who is a graduate with a degree in physics who actually worked on robots at NASA's Langley Research Center in Virginia. The stuff's really, really funny. I mean, I suppose you have to have a certain quirky sense of humor, but cracks me up. So that's xkcd.com. The other resource I came across, this is a book called Dry Store Room Number 1, The Secret Life of the Natural History Museum. It's by a fellow named Richard Forti, and it's published by Fourth Estate, or NOF, in 2008. And basically, Forti documents the different scientists and the collections in Dry Store Room Number 1, which might sound like a dry read, but according to the review in Nature, it's quite juicy. Forti's anecdotes about the scientists themselves paint a vivid picture of the characters that make up this unsung research community. And this is kind of a racy example, but apparently, after the death of a museum botanist who worked on a family of tropical plants in the early 20th century, his colleagues discovered, upon clearing his office, a card index of the guy's sexual conquests, filed, get this, alphabetically, each adorned with, and cover your kids' ears, a sprig of pubic hair. Forti ventured, once a curator, always a curator. Ugh, creepy. But anyway, I mean, if that's the kind of interesting stuff that's in this book, maybe Dry Storeroom Number 1 is worth picking up. That's it for today's show. Anne is up in 2 weeks' time. Don't forget, if you want to get in touch with Anne or myself, Julia, drop us an email at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. If you want to replay any aspect of the show, re-listen, catch a reference or website, we're podcast, of course, on CITR under Talk. Click on My Science Project and get whatever show your little heart desires. Up next is Darren with Stereoscopic Readout. I will leave you with the song You'll Never Know by Science is for Girls.
You'll never know it. You'll never see it. You'll just be there. You'll never know it. You'll never see it. You'll just be there. We'll be right back.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to
fun.
While
fun
cloaks itself in a plethora of disguises, its favorite mantle still remains
fun. Fun
devours all it touches, its voracious appetite rarely fulfilled. Yet
fun
doesn't only destroy, it creates and molds as well. Let's examine closely then this dangerously evil creation, this new breed. But a word of caution, handle it with care and don't drop it.